Hey, Rory.
Hey, what's up, man?
We are live.
So what I wanted to have a quick chat and a couple questions with you today. As I'm working on my my sort of pocketbook of resuscitation, I'm going over a bunch of things, and I was reading this article. I'll have to put up the I'll have to find it again and put it in the notes, but written by a couple of these bigwigs in critical care, and they had a chart up that was talking about the relationship between pressure and perfusion. And essentially, it's one of the graphs that they had up was essentially one of those autoregulation type curves, you know, where it goes up and it plateaus and it goes up again. And that's what they had down as a relationship between pressure and perfusion, which goes counter to a lot of the concepts that I'd had formulated, understood, whatnot. And so I wanted to know what you thought about that and take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I haven't seen the graph, but obviously you're talking about, you know, there's a certain level of MAP or perfusion that the organ can maintain a steady state. And as it drops below that kind of threshold of blood pressure, perfusion starts to drop off, or as it goes above that level, perfusion starts to drop off, or it can't control the pressure to it.
Right. Well, it seems in that graph, the perfusion was still rising.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the same graph as you've seen for, you know, cerebral blood flow autoregulation and
right.
all that sort of up, flat,
right.
up. And right. my feeling, or my clinical feeling at least, about perfusion, like tissue perfusion and blood flow, particularly when we're talking about, you know, driving it up with vasopressors as opposed to, like,
right.
you know, driving it up with inotropes or someone's, you know, blood pressure just going up with agitation and excitement and whatever. But
yeah.
let's say we've got our septic patient that we're basically trying to fine-tune or find a good blood pressure flow, blood pressure / perfusion sweet spot. It seems to me that once you're probably going to go up, of course, with pressure, because zero pressure, you're not going to get anything. And then you're going to plateau, and then you're going to get hyper vasoconstricted and perfusion is going to start to actually
right.
drop.
Decrease.
Yeah. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah. And I would agree. I mean, I wonder what the authors are actually talking about from the perspective. Is this during a normal state? And, you know, we talk about this in the brain, and you can talk about it in the kidneys, that for a certain threshold or a certain variation in blood pressure, mm-hmm. they can maintain a steady pressure to the kidney or a steady flow
right,
to the
exactly.
kidney. And autoregulation ceases at certain points, depending on the patient and depending on the state and how long they've had hypertension. I think that doesn't really stand when you're artificially changing the blood pressure with vasopressors.
Right?
Because you're actually, I think, actively manipulating the vessels that the organ is using itself to control that flow.
Right. Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I agree. I don't really know what to do with that kind of study. And also, I mean, what does that actually mean at the bedside? I think there's a lot to talk about. You know, how do we tell if we're actually perfusing a patient's organs? You know, is a MAP of 65 right for everybody? And how do we differentiate? And some people's, you know, area where they can control their own pressure might be smaller or larger depending on, where their blood pressure was before they got sick, depending on
right.
the illness they have and so forth.
Agree totally. And then the other, you know, when we're in discussing with Shagan the other day, he was talking about the uncoupling of a cardiac and arterial flow and the issues that can come up with that. And, you know, when we're measuring blood pressure or measuring the pressure that's really in the arterial tree, that is a step away from, or two steps away from the actual area where the flow occurs, which is your capillaries. And we've got our resistor that's between the pressure being measured and the perfusion, right? We've got our arterioles as our main resistor, right?
Right.
So in a sense, the relationship becomes pretty complex because you might have great pressure, but if it's because you've squeezed those resistors down to not a whole lot,
right.
well, what's coming out the other end is
yeah.
a different story. And I think that's what we've all seen clinically sometimes when you've got someone on a ton of pressors and the example I gave last time was a lady who was on, who's norepinephrine was being titrated to a radial art line, which wasn't accurate, and we put the femoral, then boom, we were able to drop, and all of a sudden the flow was fine, despite the blood pressure, you know. So the blood pressure was 140 when we put it in the fem, and when we dropped that pressure down to like 100 systolic, give or take, then the perfusion was great.
Right. I think we all come up against this, where you're just titrating up your pressors, and at some point you have to have a stop point and just say, what am I missing? And, you know, am I really actually reading what I need to be reading? And I think, you know, the patient a lot of times tells you whether it's real or not and how sick they are. And is this patient actually, should they be on that many pressors for how they look and how their, you know, organs are perfusing and so forth. And a lot of times you can kind of guess, well, that none of this quite makes sense. Maybe we should put a femoral A line in and see what our real pressure, our central pressures are.
It can be pretty tricky because if you've got one that, you know, you especially if you inherit, you know, like maybe it's been in the ED if you're in the ICU, or it's just been around for a little bit and they're intubated, they're on the multiple pressors, you know, their BP non-invasive or radial is in the 70s and 80s. It is hard to resist not doing something. I mean, I can understand docs out there being, well, we got to do something to get it up a little bit.
Yeah, and you can see how if they got there, right? Like say, you know, they had a peripheral a cuff non-invasive pressure and they're using that initially, and then they got a radial A-line. At that point, they'd already titrated the pressures up. They don't want to titrate back down, and at some point, you kind of get them to a cyclical process. Whenever I inherit those patients, I kind of have like a cognitive stop checklist where I kind of run through to make sure it's not me, so make sure the pressure transducer is in the right place. Where's my actual arterial line? You know, is it a central or is it peripheral line? Do I think actually putting in a central arterial line will give me a more reliable pressure? All that kind of stuff I kind of run through to try to decide if I'm actually, you know, titrating my pressors to something that actually makes sense, or am I just over-constricting the patient and seeing the results of that?
Right. As I think I'd mentioned before, I've been toying with using tissue oximetry for that, you know, and seeing it drop, you know, being, you know, an indicator of possible, or seeing it plateau, you know, as you're creeping up the blood pressure, being an indicator of, hey, maybe we're not, you know, improving local flow. But it would be nice to have some other measure of perfusion that could really be even more tangible than a venous extraction number.
Yeah, and I think it also, you know, there after you do all that, you know, there's a lot of patients, and I, quite frankly, I think most of them, that you put the central arterial line in and the pressure is just the same, if not worse. And then you're stuck with a group of patients in refractory shock on a boatload of pressors. And the question becomes, what is the optimal map for this kind of patient? And that's the patient who you have the most trouble with, right? I mean, the patients, you know, where we talk about like driving the map up to, you know, greater than 65 on patients, to 75 to 85. Mm-hmm. I almost never have trouble with those patients. If you can actually get their map up that high,
that's
great.
Right.
I mean, usually those patients you have some source control on already and it's not a big deal. It's the ones where you're just fighting to maintain any kind of adequate perfusion to these patients. And, you know, you're wondering when you're on these high, high levels of pressors and you start with second and third line agents, what are you doing to the end organs at that point? And is there, what should be your MAC goal there? Is should you fight for every ounce to get to 65, or is 60 better? Is it individualized? How do you actually find where the right level that you're actually getting perfusion? I think that's the most challenging patient of all these kind of patients.
Well, that's the ones that I've used, you know, a handful of times, the tissue stat, and said, well, look, if driving my MAP from 55 to 65 has resulted in no improvement of my tissue saturation, and, you know, it's at the potential cost of, I mean, it's hard to, you know, gauge finger temperature and level of modeling. It may not have changed much, but then I've backed off and used lower MAP or systolic BP, goals in order to, given that I doesn't seem to be improving my my tissue extraction there.
Yeah, and I also tend to look at the venous side at that point and see what, you know, what is the pressure we're going up against. Is, are they venous overload?
Yeah.
And venous congested? And is it purely just getting off some of that central venous excess? Will that just, you know, increase my driving pressure and help from that side as well?
Yeah, that's probably a good concept to apply to circulation as well. Just the idea of driving pressure, or, you know, perfusion pressure, which we don't hear talked about much. You know, by most standards, the venous side is essentially ignored in acute resuscitation.
Right.
Or maybe we should be paying a little more attention to it, like André has told us a little bit, and that, like you're showing us too in some of your cases. So. Okay. Cool. I think it's a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a more important point to all this, and that's, like, you know, I always view this stuff as kind of like a damage control, and like everything you give has a cost, right? Little bit of fluid you have, we all know, you know, you're going to have to get out the back end, and some of it you can't get out, and, you know, leads to increased time in the vent, more renal congestion and so forth. And even your pressors, you know, the more you add, the more cost you have, the more blood you give. And so I kind of view it in like a damage control sense, that the most important thing to me is source control. That study that was published in JAMA last year from Zambia, the Andrews et al. Study where they did, you know, an RCT in septic patients in Zambia and randomized it, essentially fluid or no fluid. And they all came in shock. And the most fascinating part to me is they were all out of shock at the same time, whether they got fluids or not.
Yep.
Right? At 6 hours or 12 hours, everyone was out of shock. And what that tells me is, you know, the resuscitation aspect has a point, but mostly source control is what's going to get you what you need. And so I kind of view it as, you know, do what you have to maintain, you know, the vital perfusion to the organs, but do the little you have to get there, or the minimal amount that you have to get there, and just ensure that you have source control and let the patient's kind of a physiology recover itself and do as little damage as you can in between those times. And that's kind of how I always use things. And whenever I have rising pressure requirements and, you know, I don't have control, I always ask myself, why don't I have source control? What am I missing? And I kind of go back and look, you know, do I have antibiotic coverage? Am I missing, you know, an access or a source that needs to get trained and all that kind of stuff before I, you know, start ramping up and just trying to
figure
out the schema that I
need. Right.
Because I think we always, you know, I really don't think we get that far when we really try to fix hemodynamics. I think, you know, you just spiral away into this kind of endless refractory shot, thinking that you can fix it by adding a little more inotrope or a little more pressure or a little more fluid.
By fixing the circulation, but it's not the main problem.
Yeah. So that's always my key, is get source control and do as little damage as you can in the time being.
Awesome. I think that's an excellent closer for this, an excellent point to bring up. Fix the main problem and just squeak by on the rest, especially with doing the least damage you can.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, always good to talk to you, Rory.
Yeah, you too, man.
Got to run back to the busy day.
Yeah, me too.
Talk soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye.